Good morning. This is what we've been reduced to.
Without the benefits of post-production, without the benefits of turning up the volume later on or putting any sort of reverb or echo on it, I got a pin from the Wardrobe Department of RTE from Catherine Manning over there. And I'm now going to live on the radio, probably never been done before for good reason. I'm going to drop it here so we can all, as a nation, on this Wednesday afternoon, hear a pin drop. Are you ready? Shh. There you go, ladies and gentlemen. That was a pin dropping. I know. Sorry. Strange times. Strange times. Strange things happen to people.
Yep, it was that kind of week. Lockdown lethargy, tedium, and the early morning stare that now stretched right through the day. But May did land in. Not that you'd notice.
There was a time when May mattered. But now it's just another blob of time, isn't it? Just moulding into another blob. Anyway, but that's fine. Let's not get too existential about things. We're here now and we're all together. All together now. It's raining. I never thought I'd be so happy to see the rain. I'm a fan of the rain, to be honest with you. And I thought, it's raining. Do you know what I liked about the rain? Change. It's different to the weather from the day before and the day before that and the day before that. As a friend of mine said to me yesterday, the kind of the most annoying thing about all of this for one person will be monotony. The monotony of the same thing. And that's a good word for a lot of people. Some people it's not monotonous at all. Won't get into that. We all know everyone's doing their thing and all that. But monotony can be an issue. And that's why the rain was welcome. It's kind of just a relief. Oh, it's different.
Oh, it's hard lines when the drop of rain brings us rushing to press our noses up against the glass. But them's the days. And if you're cocooning well, it's definitely not easy. And for many, the term itself is contentious. Not so much safe and cosy as disempowering, patronising, and for activist, academic and member of Age Action Alva Smith, enraging.
You have been cocooning. Let's maybe start with that word. Does it make you feel warm and looked after or not?
It fills me. Well, it certainly did fill me for the first 3 or 4 weeks of this intense isolation period. It filled me with a sense of rage because, you know, it was about wrapping up people over the age of 70 in cotton wool, locking them into their homes and in a very real sense, throwing away the key and saying, get on with this. We can't all be lumped together. And yet what this word in itself actually does is frame everybody over the age of 70 as the same, regardless of the state of our health, regardless of our mobility, regardless of our income, our housing situation, whether we have a partner, whether we live alone. It just simply says old people over 70 off the streets so we don't have to think about them. And indeed, we did forget about them in the nursing homes. And I'm very glad that, you know, you have discussed that. But I think that So I think the word was not thought out. It was no doubt well-intentioned because we do need, as people who are at particularly high risk of the disease, and many like me have underlying, so-called underlying problems. But at the same time, we have to, I think, as a society, actually recognise that what older people are living through and being obliged to live through is a period of great loss. Loss of freedom, loss of independence, loss of a voice, loss of status. And that fundamentally, that runs great risks for the future and for the emergence or indeed the reinforcement of already ageist attitudes.
Step up hotelier and former Wexford hurling manager Liam Griffin, who's not feeling enraged at all.
How are you coping with cocooning?
I'm coping well, I think, by staying positive. The one thing that I would say, and I hear what everybody else is saying, is management must manage in relation to anything, in relation to business, in relation to anything else. So if we were charged with the management of this whole virus, as the individuals just here on the radio, if we were asked to do that, I would rather, and I would be saying, I'd be rather better to err on the side of caution rather than have this debate as to why do we open too soon. So I think from my perspective, I don't see it as why am I staying in? Now, I have to admit that I have had a knee replacement, so I have to do 20 minutes on crutches up and down every three times a day. So that's okay for me. But what I'm saying is that Why are we staying in? And I think it's a little bit more noble than we're actually giving ourselves credit for, is to save lives. We're staying in to save lives, the same as the people who go out to look after the people in the hospitals, and all the care workers. And we're doing that. And I think from my point of view, it really is the right thing to do until the people that are managing the system go to the next level and try to relax it. And I would love to see it relaxed slightly. Very difficult when you go over 70 to say 72s can go out, 73s have to stay in, 75s can go out. You can't do it like that. They've had to pull a line, and maybe they will relax it, and they should relax it in a managed way, and I would be happy with that.
However, Alva Smith felt the toll that isolation might be taking on people was not to be underestimated.
It is actually as if we don't have an existence outside our homes. Mm. I have not been in contact. I haven't been within touching distance of a human being for 7 weeks. Now, this is not normal, and it is not right. It is. I think it's perhaps I'm not sane. How do I know? I've no objective measure of my sanity anymore. But this is bad for us mentally, psychologically, emotionally, as well as physically. And it's very bad socially. There has to be an understanding that people who are older in this great big lumped in together group, that we are getting frustrated, and also we're getting concerned. We're getting concerned about our own well-being in this state of kind of paralysis.
Alva Smith on Drive Time on Tuesday. And yesterday, Seán O'Rourke spoke to Dr. David Nabarro, WHO Special Envoy on COVID-19. And Seán asked him about the particular restrictions for those 70 and over and the possibility of easing them.
As somebody who's 70, I'm aware that I'm in the risk group. I'm thinking, yes, I want to be able to see my family, I want my children and my grandchildren, and I do want to be able to get out. But at the same time, I've got to be careful that I'm not accidentally up close to somebody who's got the COVID. They may not know that they've got it. They may only have a mild illness. And so they could accidentally infect me, and then I could end up getting into big trouble and have to go to hospital and fight for my life. So we want to be able, us older people, to connect, and we don't want to be cocooned up for a long time to come. But at the same time, we don't want to be putting ourselves at risk. And that's where ingenuity really comes in. Thinking through all of us, what does this mean for us as we go about our lives, as we connect with other people? And how can we make certain that we are able to do what we want to do and able to work as we need to do, whilst at the same time protecting those who might be at risk? I'm not answering your question, Seán. I'm sorry about that. But there's a reason for not answering it direct, because each of us has to make sense of it. Each of our governments have to be able to talk to other governments. What are your experiences? What are you finding? Because it's so many different pieces in the jigsaw. And then over time, we will get used to it. And we will go back to really full lives. We will go back to watching football. We will go back to being able to go to the pub and all those other things that we love to do. But we will have to work out with each other, with our families, with our friends, how we're going to do this while staying safe.
WHO Special Envoy Dr. David Nabarro with Seán yesterday. But while all chatter here might have been on lockdowns and easing of restrictions, what might that look like? Well, on Monday's Morning Ireland, Audrey Carville spoke to Miguel Ancho Morado in Spain.
Adults were only allowed out in very limited circumstances. Children were not allowed out at all. Is that changing now?
Yes, there's been some easing of these restrictions. Children were allowed from yesterday. They are allowed to leave their homes for 1 hour a day. In principle, they should not go to parks or beaches, or they should not gather. It's been more or less followed by the population. There are exceptions. There were some scenes yesterday of people in the beaches and even in the parks, even though the parks are closed, but people somehow managed to get into them. But in general, I think people is following these regulations, and yes, they are very strict. And there's talk that in a few days, perhaps, all the people would be allowed to leave their homes for an hour as well. But it's still very strict.
This week saw France announcing that May 11th would see an easing of restrictions. Agnès Poirier explained how that might work.
So what you will be able to do is you'll be able to leave your home without a printout form, but only if you remain in your city. If you want to go beyond 100 kilometer radius, you will need a very good reason and documents to prove that what you're doing is absolutely necessary. That is to say, either for grave, serious family reasons or for professional reasons. The other thing you'll be able to do is to go to shops, but shops will have to regulate the number of people they have inside. You'll have to be able to have to wear masks, and the same public transports. You'll be able to do some sport, but not only outdoor sports, for instance. And of course, you won't be able to go to cafes, restaurants, big museums and theatres, because they will remain closed for the foreseeable future. So there are plenty of things that will perhaps only start operate in the summer or even in September.
That was Thursday's Morning Ireland, and later on the News at One, Shona Murray of Euronews spoke to Anya Lawler about Germany.
They started tentatively lifting some restrictions on April 20th. Now, obviously, Germany is a federal system with 16 states, so they all vary, but essentially, certain schools have been allowed to open for smaller groups of children for limited sort of periods of time. Certain shops that are larger than 800 square meters are open. You know, anywhere that can basically practice social distancing rules has been allowed to open. Now, the problem is, though, just this week, they've seen a rise in the basic reproduction number of cases and of deaths. So there may be an issue here for member states who are preparing to sort of open up from the 4th, 5th and 6th of May onwards. So the reproduction number, of course, is the number of new cases that one infected person can create. And that has risen to one. And it came from 0.7. So Angela Merkel is meeting with the sort of leaders of the Länder and today the federal states to see if they may have to put a halt and retreat on some of the sort of easing of restrictions that they've decided. And of course, that may have implications for other countries who have been obviously under lockdowns, very strict lockdowns for several weeks.
And it's a very delicate balancing act. I saw one report that Mrs. Merkel has told German churches while they may reopen, they may not sing. Because there have been cases, of course, associated with transmission and singing.
Oh, this truly is an unforgiving virus. That was Shauna Murray with Anya Lawler on the News at One. Ida Milne is the author of Stacking the Coffins, Influenza, War and Revolution in Ireland, 1918-19. She spoke to Shauna Rourke about the parallels between our situation today and that of the Spanish flu in 1918.
Remind us, how many people in Ireland died from the Spanish flu?
About 23,000, including excess pneumonias, and there was probably about 800,000 cases over 10 months or so.
Yeah, and what similarities do you see between what's happening now with the coronavirus and how the Spanish flu was dealt with 100 years ago?
Well, I suppose the major thing is that Spanish flu kind of gives an indication of the picture we would have had if we didn't have lockdown. And that hopefully we've slowed and reduced the numbers of deaths that we had. Like, I mean, those 23,000 deaths mostly came in 10 months in 1918, in three waves. The first wave very mild, the second two waves much more severe, particularly in Dublin. Where there is closer.
Was
mingling.
There an element of complacency then in the population? Maybe things eased off a little bit and they started to congregate or recongregate?
Definitely. I mean, the first wave was so mild that people just thought it was something, a bit of an aberration. And they started mixing and playing Gaelic games and everything like that. But the second and third waves then, the Gaelic games continued, but they ended up having to defer the finals, just like we're going to have now, until 1919. Both the senior football and hurling finals were deferred until 1919.
Oh, so there's a precedent for what we spoke to John Horan.
Does that sound familiar? Well, the similarities did not end there.
The Irish Times of the 28th of October that year, 1918, reported that he was obviously well past retirement age. 88 Sir Charles Cameron. He was the Tony Houlihan of his day. He had some interesting things to say about complacency.
Yeah, the Dublin Medical Officer of Health for Dublin Corporation. He had been working tirelessly for 50 years or so to improve the health of Dubliners. And he did. He wanted people to stay at home. He kept advising, very practical, plain advice, an expert communicator. And journalists kept going to them. And he kept telling people, stay at home until you're well better. Stay out of circulation. Too many people are trying to go out and about. I think that particular...
And the quote is, if the public would only wake up to the seriousness of the condition of things and avoid meeting in crowds, the risk of spreading the infection might be minimised. But clearly the advice was largely ignored.
Yes, I think so. I think that as time went on, during the very peak weeks when very many people within a community would be sick, people would stay at home for fear of getting it. But once the peak would pass in a local area, they'd go out and about again and obviously cause more peaks.
Ida Milne with Sean. And speaking of out and about, Drive Time's John Cook was in Limerick at a Gartha checkpoint where he met this man on a mission.
We're coming from Donegal. We're going down to Cork just to pick up a dog. Just.
It's a long way for a dog, is it?
Well, women like dogs, just that's it.
And who's the dog for? Who's the woman?
Oh, just a friend. Just a friend, just.
Okay. And you offered to go all the way to Cork to get her a dog?
Well, I was going as far as Athlone anyway, for the mower, so.
So you drove to Athlone from Donegal to pick up a... Is it a lawnmower?
No, it's an agricultural mower.
It's in your trailer there. Did you encounter many of these Garda checkpoints on the way?
That was the second one. The other one waved his own.
Do you want to just pull in here in front of the Garda car on the right just for a second?
Right. The way it is, like... If you don't go down now and get the dog, when do you go and get it? Like, you know, you have to get the pup when it's young. You can't get it whenever it's too old or it's too late. You know, it has to be trained. That's the problem. What do you do, like?
So I know that you're saying that it's important to get the pup young to train it and stuff. So that's not an essential journey, lads, at the moment. Granted, the mower is essential. That's part of your business. I don't think we're even going to go into the trailer and wrong ridges and inessential stickers on the windscreen and non-conforming number plates. What I'm going to get you to do is I'm going to be logging this incident. I'm going to leave it that I'm cautioning you in relation to it, basically just trying to encourage you to comply with the restrictions. Rather than going through the tunnel, you're going to go off to the slip road here on the left-hand side, up and around, and it'll bring you down in this carriageway. You're going to be meeting a checkpoint on the far side of the road. You can tell them that you're after being turned around. We're using technology here, ANPR, automatic number plate recognition. If you try and attempt to head back to Cork after this, I think you know what's going to happen.
You're being told you have to go home, lads. How do you feel about that?
Well, it says here we're half an hour away, so it's a bit of a kick in the teeth, like, but what do you do? What harm was it really for... We're not even coming in contact with the man. The man's leaving the dog there and we're picking it up, like, but stuff like that is stupid, but what do you do? We're not the law.
A report from Thursday's Drive Time with John Cook. Oh, the things we'll do for a dog and a woman.
Dig the lava line.
Back in a bit. Welcome back. The death was announced on Monday of poet Yvan Boland. And Irina had a special programme paying tribute to her enormous contribution to both Irish and international poetry. Here is Yvan Boland reading her poem, Quarantine.
In the worst hour of the worst season of the worst year of a whole people, a man set out from the workhouse with his wife. He was walking, they were both walking north. She was sick with famine fever and could not keep up. He lifted her and put her on his back. He walked like that, west and north, until at nightfall. Under freezing stars, they arrived. In the morning, they were both found dead, of cold, of hunger, of the toxins of a whole history. But her feet were held against his breastbone. The last heat of his flesh was his last gift to her. Let no love poem ever come to this threshold. There is no place here for the inexact praise of the easy graces and sensuality of the body. There is only time for this merciless inventory. Their death together in the winter of 1847. Also, what they suffered, how they lived, and what there is between a man and woman, and in which darkness it can best be proved.
Quarantine by Yvan Boland, whose death was announced on Monday. And poet Elaine Quillenon paid tribute to Boland's work, particularly as a woman working in what was a very male-dominated world.
Her first collection, 23 poems, was published in 1962. How difficult a task would it have been for her, Lynn Nicholinan, to break into what was essentially a boys' club at that point in this country in the 1960s?
Yes, I think there were a lot of poets who wanted to make the point that almost to make poetry safe for men, you know. There were, of course, women writers who had tend to get forgotten from time to time. But I think, first of all, she must have been awfully young in 1962. I met her in 1967 and she was in her early 20s then. She was, she did start very early, and I think then at a certain point she found a really strong voice which was public, which was addressed, I think, probably mainly to women, but which was about the importance of their lives historically and in the present as well. And at the same time, it was very personal. She was very much a person who wrote out of her own life, but the address, the public part of it, was so authentic. I think it sort of, one might almost say it carried her along. It did widen her audience, her particular, her personal audience, almost effortlessly, I think.
Poet Elaine Ní Chuilíneán on Monday night's Arena Special. Another contributor to that programme was Fintan O'Toole. He recognised Boland's importance not just as a poet, but also as a public figure.
We have an expectation of our poets in Ireland, you know, which is maybe unfair, that they also, you know, fulfil a certain kind of public function. And by God, she was well able for that. People will remember, certainly people of a certain age will remember the, you know, spine-tingling inaugural address, rather, of Mary Robinson as president in 1990, which was, of course, the first moment that Ireland had ever had a female head of state. And she quoted Evan Boland, of course, in that speech. And she did it, of course, because, you know, they were friends, they'd been comrades in arms in the feminist movement. But also, I think, quite rightly marking the sense that Evan Boland was very much a part of social change in Ireland. You know, she was someone who made a choice to occupy public space.
And again, the importance of Boland as a poet and a woman working in Ireland was highlighted. Here is Olivia O'Leary.
I'm looking at a quote from Evan herself. I began to write in an Ireland where the word woman and the word poet seemed to be in some sort of magnetic opposition to each other. What kind of intellectual energy would you need to fight that kind of magnetic force, Olivia O'Leary?
Massive intellectual energy, and she had it. And she, I gather, did go to McDade's pub in the early 60s, but never actually partook of alcohol. But there was one poem particularly that she produced, which was looked at by various people, and whether it was there or in Belfast, I don't know, but seemingly Derek Mahon looked at it and was very approving of it and said it could have been written by a man. And I don't think she was terribly she was terribly impressed. But she, you keep on going back. Do you know the way when a singer or a musician has died and we end up talking about her or him instead of listening to the music? So could I beg your forgiveness and just read a short poem of hers called The Singers?
Please do.
Which is the one that Fintan O'Toole referred to earlier and the one that Mary Robinson quoted from in her famous speech when she became president. The Singers. The women who were singers in the West lived on an unforgiving coast. I want to ask, was there ever one moment when all of it relented, when rain and ocean and their own sense of home were revealed to them as one and the same? After which every day was still shaped by weather, but every night their mouths filled with Atlantic storms and clouded over stars and exhausted birds, and only when the danger was plain in the music could you know the true measure of rejoicing in finding a voice where they found a vision.
The Singers by Evan Boland, read by Olivia O'Leary, who joined Sean Rocks on an Arena special to mark the death of the poet on Monday. On Tuesday, Ryan Tuberty spoke to journalist Ginger Gorman, who in 2010 wrote a story that drew the ire of nasty online commentators, and she began to be trolled.
And what happened was a conservative commentator in the States got hold of the story and started to write these factually inaccurate blog posts about me. This man, Robert Stacey McCain, had thousands of followers. He's a quite well-known journalist there. And he was inciting people to shame me. So because he had thousands of followers, I literally just started to get waves and waves of hatred, like pouring into my social media accounts. And it just became absolutely terrifying because I had two little babies. And one of the tweets I got said, "Your life is over." And at that point, I realized my tweets were geolocated. So you could actually click on them and see my house on Google Maps. And then at the same time, my husband found this photo of my family, our family, on a fascist website. And that was really threatening because my mum's family have fled the Holocaust. And so, you know, a number of our family members died in the Holocaust. So these two things together, this death threat with the map and then, you know, these kind of really severe fascist threats were just terrifying. And I just have this memory of lying in bed at about 11 o'clock at night, just in cold fear, listening to my little babies, like breathing in the next room and just thinking, did I just put my kids' lives in danger?
And she set out to learn more about these trolls, and this became her book, Troll Hunting.
I very easily found them, which surprised me. They wanted to talk to me, which is really interesting. Like, they feel marginalized, they feel unheard. They are very angry young men, most of them. They're not exclusively men, but mostly they are angry men with kind of white supremacist, outright misogynistic tendencies. Trolling is a culture. These guys are in international syndicates, almost like, you know, rebel motorcycle gangs and things like that. And they have presidents and vice presidents, and they're proud of the culture. It took me a while to wrap my head around it because I'm everything they hate, right? They hate women. They hate journalists. They especially hate white women. They hate Jews. They hate people in mixed race marriages. They hate people who are left wing. Like, if it was a dating app, I was like a perfect hate match.
Yeah.
And there were certain traits that they all shared.
They're all quite sadistic. So trolling is correlated with what they call the dark tetrad of personality traits. So it's Machiavellianism, the psychopathy, narcissism, and sadism. But sadism is the strongest link. So that was one of the few commonalities I found between them. They wanted to upset people. They wanted to hurt people. And they took pleasure in it.
And in her view, it's not simply a case of keyboard warriors remaining hidden behind the screen in their rooms.
At the extreme end, you know, like the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville where Heather Hoyer was killed, I mean, that was incited by trolls. That was incited by the troll army from the Daily Stormer website. So we need to be really clear that, you know, at the extreme end, it's very frightening. And the police don't have a handle on this. You know, I've spoken about this in New Zealand after the Christchurch massacre because the Christchurch killer was a troll. I've spoken about it in Norway. You know, police are so out of their depth and they don't understand that these kind of right-wing troll boards on 4chan and 8chan I'll link to some of these really extreme white nationalist terrorist acts.
Ginger Gorman talking about her book Troll Hunting with Ryan on Tuesday. Anton Savage came into studio to talk to Shona Rourke about road trips for when we do get released, for we shall be released. And first up, the Glens of Antrim, but with a caveat.
The only recommendation I will make to you is all of the signs will point you to the Giant's Causeway. Have you ever been to the Giant's Causeway?
I was there last August, so be careful now.
Has there ever been a bigger anticlimax in your life?
I had a lovely day. Sorry, I had a lovely 2 hours in Giant's Causeway. I didn't care too much for their coffee, but I managed. I bought some nice presents for people, some great fudge, and I had a good walk for myself. A slightly challenging one.
There's a career in the diplomatic corps ahead for you, Sean, because the Giant's Causeway, to everybody else in the world, they get to it and they think, well, okay, this is obviously the one they use as the aperitif or as the amuse-bouche before we get the real Giant's Causeway, and then spend the rest of their life thinking, that's it.
Sparky, not short of an opinion, our Anton. And when it came to driving across the States, he also had a view on that.
When you rent the car, it has to be a convertible Mustang.
But what if you're over 27? You know, of course, why I'm asking that question, don't you?
This is because no man over 27 should own a convertible.
Something like that. Unless he's doing an ad for Viagra. Isn't that what you told me a year ago? putting pay to all my hopes.
I should have added the caveat that if you're driving coast to coast, transcontinentally across Route 10 in America, you get to have a convertible Mustang, Sean.
Okay, fair enough. Now you have...
Nothing less will do. And of course, Sean is getting fierce giddy as he inches ever closer to the door. And we learned his lockdown anthem this week. I'd figured a ballad, something a bit traditional, a bit of Planxty, a blast to Christie, but no. Roll up your jacket sleeves, turn up the collar and break out the white man's overbite. For it was this. Lionel Richie, who'd have thunk it? Back in a bit. But down with the air guitar, Sean. Down. That's it. Welcome back. Thursday's Liveline. Well, it was the most liveliniest liveline in a very long time. It was all about Normal People, which is a novel by Sally Rooney, now adapted for the telly by Lenny Abrahamson. It had aired on RTE during the week and featured two 17-year-olds having what I like to call special grown-up wrestle hugs. However, callers into Liveline, well, there was no need for it. Here's Tommy.
In the second episode, as I say, I've only seen one and two, there's some nudity, male and female. Is that what you object to?
Well, it is. It's giving the wrong message, Joe, to young people. Like, I have two daughters now, and if they think that that's what's going on in secondary schools, it's shocking, and I don't think you would like,
okay,
you know.
So, Tommy, it's not just the nudity, it's the age of the actors.
Exactly,
is that correct?
Joe, exactly. Now, that's it, because I'll
and
tell
the
you
age.
What,
and I just want to be clear on this. Mm. It's not just the age, because I think if Daisy Edgar Jones, I don't know if she's 21 now, but then she would have been 20 when they made it, but it's the age that they portray, isn't it?
Exactly.
You're saying.
Okay. Now you said it, Jack, Joe, because if you look at all the classmates of that girl in that school, they were all teenagers, you know, and they see this going on, and this is normal, and it's giving the wrong message to young people, and, you know...
Yeah, but they're not getting their role models and their boundaries from television programmes these days.
Oh, they are.
But Tommy, they're getting it from social media and...
Yeah, well, I agree, but you'd rarely see that on social media unless you went into a pornographic channel, you know, and then...
Ooh, a pornographic channel, Tommy. Well, David agreed with you.
I have to say, Joe, I think every parent that has teenage daughters or sons would actually cringe watching that, because I had to cringe. To think of teenagers and then they're just, how to say, you know, jumping into this, you know, sexual thing. You know, I, as a parent, I had to switch the channel. I have a young son and a daughter. Mm. But I mean, I have to think of parents that saying, is this what they call normal? Is you send your children to school in the school uniform? And, you know, they're young teenagers, just things they can be doing like football or school or drama or tennis. And we're saying, no, they just have to be sexualised. I mean, we have enough problem with all this.
But the age of consent in the country is 17, and they are six-year students. They are hoping to go to university. The consent scene in the first 8 minutes of the second episode could be used, because it's a big issue, could be used as a masterclass in obtaining and giving consent from both parties.
But, Joe, the message this is employing here, the truth of it is, the message is employing here is that we're sexualising our young people.
Indeed.
Okay, And that's the message that's coming from this programme. It's all about sexualising them. Our young people just need to grow, you know, live their lives, mm-hmm. you know, play tennis, do football, get involved in other things. They don't need all this sexualisation shoved down their throats on television 24/7. I actually, as I said, I can, parents with teenagers, and they're saying, oh, man, but that's normal. It's not normal. It's not normal for them. There's things that they could be doing with their lives that is more productive rather than, you know...
Rather than loving each other.
Oh, you big free love hippie, Duffy. Back to Tommy.
Again, I don't want to be her. Have you held these views for a long time?
Of course, Joe, I have, yeah. When we were in school, and you might remember too, you learned your catechism by heart. You knew your commandments, you knew what's right and wrong, you know, and it helped you. It helped lead a happy life. Sex was frowned upon before marriage. You wouldn't dare ask a girl to go to bed with you. You might think about it, or she'd get a slap in the face from her.
But
you know?
Is it always the boy asking the girl? Can the girl not ask the boy?
Oh, of course, Joe. Yeah, absolutely. You know, you get a slap in the face from a girl 20, 30 years ago if you suggested going to bed. You know, they'd say, do you think I'm a slut? Do you think I'm like that? You know, that's not the type of person I am. That was the attitude then, Joe. That's what we grew up with. And
what's the male version of a slut, to use your language? No, does that roll off your tongue? What's the male version of a slut?
Well, that's it. You see, unfortunately,
What is the male version of a slut? That awful, obnoxious word you've just used.
A dickhead.
Used.
I would say a dickhead.
Well, it's not. But anyway, stay with us, Tommy, please.
Okay.
Tommy, you saying you got a slap?
No, I didn't, Joe.
No, sorry.
Oh, Tommy, you might be getting a slap in a second. Here comes Maura.
Tommy, by the way, I meant to ask you earlier on that we said I was pulling you up, wasn't I? Was making, but you said married women rang you. Why would they ring you? Do you have a role in the community?
Well, they know they would be a bit shy about going on the radio themselves, you know. So they asked me if I go on.
Oh, did they?
Good friends.
Okay, talk
you know.
To Tommy. Okay, Maura Quinn. Maura, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
You're listening
I'm
to Tommy.
I'm a married woman. And I'm able to express my own opinion.
Yeah, go ahead.
I suppose the main point I wanted to make, and I'm a mother of two teenage boys, is that there was some part of what Tommy said earlier about young boys being, you know, more highly sexualized than girls. I'd love to know where he got the information from. Like, girls are as interested in sex as boys, and I hope that's a wake-up call for some of the nation, there seems to be a sort of a theory in his argument that sex is something that boys do to girls, you know, and the girls lie back and think of the empire. I'm sorry, not in my world, you know. I just think the programme was beautifully done, the consenting was beautifully handled, and, you know, I would love to think my boys were as sensitive to any girls they have the... you know, pleasure of making love with in the future. The age of the youth involved in the programme didn't disturb me at all. They were 17, they were exploring their sexuality, whether people like it or not. We're all sexual beings, we're all animals. You know, we might wear clothes, but sex is fun, and it should be fun, and it doesn't have to come within the premise of marriage, in my opinion.
So why did you get married then?
Because I love my husband.
But why didn't you stay single? If you say, you know, humans are like animals, why did you bother getting married?
Because I love my husband and I wanted to
commit
to him.
Oh, I know. Well, I know you love your husband. Yeah, that's good. And I'm delighted that you did get married. But if you see no difference between sex inside marriage and outside marriage, why bother at all, you know?
Because there's more to marriage than sex. Why take up a lot of your
day? I agree with you. Yeah, there is, of course.
But then it came back full circle to just what did we mean by normal?
This has been going on since humans were on this planet. This has been going on. So it's not a new normal.
Well, it's portrayed in the media day in and day out. And I think our young people need a break from sexualization and being
sexualized.
But if
you look at the name of the programme, what's the name of the programme? What was the name of the programme?
It's not normal for your teenage daughter to be getting into bed with another school kid. That's
Indeed.
Not normal.
That is normal.
No,
that is normal.
No, it's not normal.
And lest you be in any doubt, the name of the book and the TV series is Normal People. That was Liveline on Thursday. And staying ever so slightly on topic, bear with me, Ray Darcy spoke to comedian Joanne McNally about working in lockdown and love.
Comedy's been hit hard because there are no gigs. But Joanne McNally is looking on the bright side, are you, Joanne?
Well, not anymore after that introduction, Ray. Joanne's career is over. Let's hear from Joanne. Welcome.
Great to talk to you, Joanne.
Comedy is dead. How are you feeling, Joanne? Great, Ray.
No, but the irony,
this is like my eulogy.
The irony of it is we need comedy more than ever.
I know, but we're not allowed out. We're not allowed go to us.
Yeah. So have you done any Zoom? Have you done a Zoom gig?
No, I haven't. I've been asked to do a few of them, actually, and I've said no. And in hindsight, maybe I shouldn't have because there was money in some of them. But my feeling on it is that comedy is a collaborative, two-way experience.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? Like, I need laughs and energy, and not just because I've got low self-esteem, but it's because it makes the gig move. It's what you ride on. You ride the energy. If there's no laughs, it's like doing a TED talk. It's like doing a really bad gig. It's like I've done gigs to silence before. It's not something I want to relive. It's not something I would choose to do. Do you know what I mean? So I've just said no.
And then the conversation went here.
Dating, you know, during a lockdown.
Yeah. What's the point? Are they going to come round and stroke your hair through the letterbox? See what about it? Just wait. I've waited this long.
Is there FaceTime? Any, you know, FaceTime contact?
How embarrassing. Is I don't even like FaceTime because I'm like, no. Like, what am I going to FaceTime a stranger? It's like doing an interview. Anyway, you need to be in the room with someone to see if there's physical chemistry. That's my feeling on it.
Is it? All right.
Talk to me in 3 weeks' time, though, when I think my hymen's regrown. I might be having a very different conversation with you. I'm like, maybe that's the weight gain. It's not the food. It's my hymen's grown back. That's probably about 4 pounds.
I love that. There's a sort of an unusual side effect of lockdown, isn't it? Loving a lockdown.
A lot of healing going on. Mental healing, physical healing.
Regrowth.
Regrowth. I'm rejuvenating, Ray. I've been revirginized.
Joanne McNally with Ray Purefield. Well, that is it from this week's Playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week.